The 800th anniversary of the Franciscans. Pope Francis and Saint Francis on the periphery of interreligious dialogue. When Archbishop David Moxon, director of the Anglican Centre in Rome, invited me to give a presentation at the centre, he suggested the topic, The Francis Effect, a close walk with Pope Francis and his inspiration, Francis of Assisi. My own patron, St. Columban, gives us the vision to be pilgrims for Christ, peregrinari pro Christo, and I suppose another translation of peregrinari is to wander. So I hope you will forgive me if I have wandered too far from the charted path Archbishop David gave me and willfully led elsewhere under the topic Pope Francis and St. Francis and the periphery of interreligious dialogue. Since I came to Rome in 2011, the Anglican Centre in Rome has been where my heart is at home. Missionary activity without a commitment to and engagement in ecumenism is a dead duck. It seems to me that considering Pope Francis and St. Francis and the periphery of interreligious dialogue takes on special relevance in the immediately now context of the massive people movement taking place in Europe from both Africa through Italy and Syria and other Middle Eastern countries, especially through Greece and beyond. I am at the same time concerned that issues in interreligious dialogue are being seen majorly in terms of Islam and Muslims, with the result that the wellsprings of devotion and holiness manifested by Hindus, Buddhists and Sikhs and other believers are being marginalised and even, can we say, peripheralised. For example, an article in the June 2015 issue of the Australian Journal of Mission Studies savaged St. Francis of Assisi. St. Francis, as you may know, joined the boats carrying the Fifth Crusade in 1219 and got himself to Damietta on a missionary journey to convert Sultan Malik at Carmel. And before this, in 1212, he had set off on a missionary journey to Syria, but didn't get very far as he was shipwrecked on the other side of the Adriatic. Afterwards, in 1213, he tried to go to Morocco but became desperately ill while travelling south through Spain. We find this urge of the heart of St. Francis towards Muslims manifested in the rule that he wrote in 1223 at Fonte Colombo near Rieti, with a sense of desperation to ensure his vision for his brothers when he appealed to them to go among Muslims in a peaceful way. However, this article I have referred to claims that Francis compromised himself by travelling in the boats connected with the Fifth Crusade. His intentions were good, but his association with the Fifth Crusade conveyed a contrary message. Leaving aside the fact that Ryanair wasn't about at the time and that the only way to get to Egypt 800 years ago was to get on one of the many boats sailing back and forth with the Crusaders, it is more helpful to see what Sultan Malik thought about St. Francis's arrival at his court. Francis was a dishevelled, unkempt man like the many dervishes and malangs that must have infested Malik's court at Damietta. Orthodox Christians in the pay of the Sultan would have been there as well. So Francis's appearance was not that of a Christian coming to the court, but an odd man from the West appearing suddenly on the Sultan's doorstep. According to the Frieri di San Francisco, the Sultan and his advisers prepared a trap for Francis, much like what happened in Iran after the fall of the Shah, when crosses were painted on the floors at the entrances to public buildings so that people would walk on them in derision. And when Francis was invited to meet the Sultan, and he was invited, not dragged in as a prisoner, carpets were laid at the entrance with crosses woven into them. And Francis strolled happily forward, looking towards the Sultan without worrying where his feet fell. mocked for walking on the cross, his sacred sign, Francis is reported to have cheerily said, "We have the true cross. You have the crosses of the two thieves, and that is what I'm walking on." I can imagine the applause that must have come at Francis's quick-witted and sensible repartee. He may have thrown off the clothes of his father when he chose Lady Poverty, but he still had the sharp wit and capacity for happy banter in which he was educated by his mother. We know nothing more except that the Sultan set Francis on his way, moved, no doubt, by his encounter with this strangely holy man. It seems to me that not only was the author of the article I have referred to mistaken history, but has more seriously misread the hearts of both Francis and Sultan Malik. Francis lived on the margins of society in Italy and struggled to remain on the ecclesiastical periphery where he would not be overwhelmed by the world of popes and cardinals and the demands on him to write a sensible rule. He travelled to a far periphery in Syria to meet the Sultan. The periphery for Francis was not simply a geographic measurement to be travelled. He had what I want to call an inner periphery, which impelled him and enabled him to move imaginatively well beyond. I think St. Paul was impelled by this inner periphery when he said, "Caritas Christi ergat nos," the love of Christ impels us beyond the beyond. I see Pope Francis summoning us to walk back through imaginatively and recreatively where we have plodded in the past, and at the same time to be impelled creatively and happily by our own personal inner periphery to live and move and have our being in the context of the religious, political, social and economic peripheries of our world. Our unlimited inner periphery enables us to stretch beyond, to imagine beyond, to think of the possibilities rather than the obstacles from the perspective of ad majorem Dei gloriam, for the greater glory of God, without a preoccupation with where I stand in the pecking order. I think it's a sort of partially realized immortality as a movement into the limitlessness of God. Pope Francis encourages us to have a religious imagination that engages our inner periphery so that we may keep seeking God in all things. For many people, the challenge and distant margin of fruitful interreligious dialogue, some prefer to say interfaith dialogue, sit out there on the intellectual or faith periphery as unachievable. Often the reference point is that because there is so much religious-based terrorism, then we need to have religious dialogue to back the fires and cool the tensions and to be seen to be doing something or other. Violence in the name of God has penetrated the streets of London, Paris, Melbourne and Sydney, without speaking of the awful bestialities being committed in Syria, Nigeria and Sahel Africa and elsewhere. The response to this is not a knee-jerk, let's dialogue, or throwing money at committees to de-radicalise youth. As Pope Francis said in 2014 while in Jerusalem, and Pope Benedict said in 2009 at Regensburg, there must be a rallying cry for solidarity between men and women of goodwill against the violence of fundamentalism, to name the evil and to embrace one another in the heart. May no one abuse the name of God through violence. The issue, of course, at the heart of fundamentalist-based violence is not religion but atheism, which denies the divine reality of God and elevates a humanly constructed control model to which God is expected to conform. And this is why I'm speaking about the periphery of religious dialogue with all believers and not just Muslims because they happen to be in the news. This sort of periphery is not an unachievable, but an expanded religious imagination that enables our hearts to dialogue, a dialogue that is more primary than the activity of our minds. 60 years ago, Nostra Aetate from Vatican II, the document on other faiths, called us to have the religious imagination to be able to recognize truth and holiness in other religions. And this was part of the breakthrough language at Vatican II, and I feel it is a language still waiting to break through now, 60 years later. There is a wonderful Urdu proverb that seems to have been made to describe the dialogue of believers. Dil si dil tak ra hoti hai, or the surest road is the one that runs from one heart to another. Cardinal Newman had a similar motto, cor ad cor locuta, or heart speaks to heart. For St. Francis, it didn't matter what he was or wasn't standing on when he came to meet the Sultan. I'd like to think that the only people during that encounter in Damietta in 1219 who knew what was going on were Francis and the Sultan through their encounter in the heart. The rest of them, with their games, just didn't matter. In his first message in January 2014 for the World Day of Peace, Fraternity, the Foundation and Pathway to Peace, Pope Francis spoke repeatedly about fraternity. It has been his constant message ever since. Pope Francis has called us to communion in our hearts. He has appealed to us to build bridges. Fraternity, community, bridges. I think that taking these from Pope Francis and joining them to call of Nostra Aetate to recognize truth and holiness in the hearts of believers can nurture in us the religious imagination needed for dialogue. Pope Francis shows us that what enables us to use our religious imagination in dialogue is a commitment to compassion and a readiness to be pilgrims who are explorers, who are not self-sufficient and who cannot afford to be superior. That article from Rome, written by Father Robert McCulloch, is rector of Collegio San Colombano in Rome.